In order for your antenna to have more gain, it's got to have more area. In order to have more area, you've got to take some chunk of space and fill it up with elements. In the case of a phased array, you might decide that, hey, I'm going to design a moonbound antenna for 432, and the usual threshold of a reasonable sized antenna is 400 square feet of effective area on 432. Call it 20 foot wide, 20 foot high, and you're going to fill up that space with Yagis, dipoles and reflectors, if it's a collinear, or an array of Yagis, long Yagis, short Yagis, all with the right spacing. You're filling up that 400 square feet with antennas. Of the signal that falls on that 400 square feet of real estate that you've declared for your moonbound antenna, you'd like to gather the majority of that antenna with that energy when you're receiving it. And by way of your phasing harness and power dividers, hopefully it all ends up on your transmission line. It goes into your low noise preamplifier that's mounted in the middle of the antenna. And then with low noise figure and lots of gain, it gets shoved down the transmission line into the receiver, gets in the shack, and out comes that moonbound signal. So gain is area. You can't double the gain of an antenna, make it 3 dB higher, without doubling its effective capture area. That's very basic physics. And so, if I'm building a collinear, a station master-like antenna, I gain that extra area vertically stacking multiple elements, multiple half-wave elements. That's where the gain comes from. And because I've made it multiple wavelengths high, vertically, I now have a more narrow vertical beamwidth. But because it's a collinear stack of elements, my as-usual pattern is essentially unaffected. So I end up with a pancake-like pattern. So I take this nearly isotropic pattern that looks like an apple in three-dimensional space, and I squeeze it down to a pancake. That's where the extra gain is coming from, even though it's still an antenna that works 360 degrees in azimuth. It's a omnidirectional antenna with extra gain. But I've had to put extra elements in there to give me the extra area. Now, when it comes to a single dipole-like element or monopole-like element, and there are various people who think if you can keep the current constant along the length of the element, you'll end up with superior performance as opposed to being a normal monopole. So I can take a normal vertical ground plane antenna, I got an infinite sheet of metal in my ideal case for the counterpoise. I've got this quarter wavelength thing coming out of the ground plane. I call it the radiator. And now if I want to squeeze down the radiator in length, I can put loading coils at the bottom, the middle, or the top. The loading coil at the top really is the top at capacitor. There's various ways I can squeeze down the length of the antenna, and I can try to make the current along the antenna more uniform. Just sitting in the ocean. A full quarter wave ground plane versus one that is electrically shortened. The difference in gain is a few tenths of a dB. That's all. When you make the whole antenna 5/8 of a wavelength long, mechanically, and electronically you're making it 3/4 of a wavelength long, yes, you do pick up an extra dB and a half or so. But you really are doing the equivalent of adding an extra element, as if it was a station master. The station master, depending on which model number you're using, has got 3, 4, or 5 elements, all half wavelength long mostly, all vertically stacked above each other, all fed in phase. You're getting the area by really putting more elements there to control the gain, the current along a single element. I think you're going to get super gain out of doing that. There is an increase, but is it worth all the effort as opposed to just putting another element there? I don't think it's worth it. That's an opinion. There are lots of guys who have spent an awful lot of man hours experimenting with the loading coils distributed along the antenna, single element, trying to get more uniform current along that element, hoping it's going to give them a lot more gain. Well, does that technique of making the current along the element more uniform, did it really give them more effective capture area? That's what counts. That's where the rubber meets the road. If you want more gain, you must create more effective radio area. I'm not convinced it's worth it, but that's an opinion. There are people who strongly disagree with that opinion. KQKUI, KQLIW.
this is K2KY. Well, this has been that discussion. Yeah. Remember that about the antenna. If I remember correctly, we looked at it and they put a bunch of capacitors. Remember with the mounting plates, plexiglass, you cut them up and drill holes. Stuck a whole bunch of them along the dipole, and supposedly because it's the full wavelength long dipole, and it's supposed to be a very high efficient dipole, better than 98% of a regular dipole. There's where I, you know, like you say, very skeptical when you hear that thing, that they actually claim that will radiate the power you put into, but 98% efficiency of a regular, do better than 98% efficiency of a regular dipole thing. That's what that CCD antenna is supposed to do. Well, they're selling them, they advertise them. According to what I looked at that time, he says that gain on that dipole, what the heck did he say? If a regular dipole, he said, measured at about 0.9 dB at the time on that particular dipole, that particular one that he's working on there, I don't remember, was a 40 meter or whatever it was. I don't remember which one. And he says that the full wave DCT version of his was about 1.3 dB. I think that's what he said. I'm so confused. But I guess if this refresh your memory is what I'm talking about, Dick, so repeat.
Yes, it does. I do remember some of his earlier discussion, Mel. First of all, a dipole or a monopole measured correctly so that it doesn't have nearby resistive elements near it. In other words, if I put a vertical ground plane antenna in my backyard, don't lay anything down enough radials, I'm now using the earth nearby as a distributed resistive material, which is going to increase the loss of the antenna. And that's not fair to blame that on the antenna. That's the environment where you're mounting it. Take that exact same antenna, mount it a few wavelengths above the ground, and you're going to get the full efficiency out of it. Every reasonable dipole that doesn't have nearby resistive material, like Mother Earth, in the reactive near field of the antenna, every reasonable antenna has nearly 100% efficiency. You put 100 watts in the antenna, and 99 watts is going to be radiating in space somewhere, as long as you don't violate that first law. Now, as I start making the antenna physically longer, I have the ability to capture more area, and if I'm smart enough to resonate it by putting distributed capacitors, inductors, or whatever, I'm now making a longer antenna that's capable of more gain. But now let's flip around and look at the more traditional approach. If I took the station master approach, and I'm making a one wavelength long antenna, I could do it by the CCD approach, or I could do it by the station master approach by making a pair of half wavelength radiators that are collinear coupled to each other. Each individual dipole, half wave dipole, has a gain of 2.14 dB over isotropic. Stack a pair of them as a one wavelength antenna, I will get close to 3 dB of gain increase over one dipole. Not quite, because they're a little bit too close. There's a little bit of overlapping of the area. My guess is the answer is more like 2.3, 2.4, 2.5 dB. A gain increase of a full wavelength pair of half-wave dipoles coupled together as if they were a station master. So if a one wavelength antenna built like a station master can give me 2.4 dB over dipole, which is 4.5 dB, almost 4.5 and a half dB over isotropic, I'd rather go with that approach than distributing a whole bunch of capacitors along a piece of wire that's one wavelength long. That's my impression. I'm not saying that the CCD doesn't work. I'm just not convinced it's the best way to do it. Now, there may be some extra bandwidth you're getting out of that. properly tuned, maybe he's getting some extra bandwidth. And maybe that's worth fighting for. But when it comes to extra gain, is that the best way to do it? You can see, I'm starting off skeptical until I see some more data. But back to you, Bill. KQLIW.
This is KQLIW. I remember correctly, I read it at the time, and we had also had a lot of questions. I think I read that. I think the main claim was that the DCD antenna was full wavelength, and because they set the beat point, the beat point peak was 300 ohms, and it said, so this makes it was much easier to match than the resistance that you find at the center of a full wave dipole stick. And you see what I'm saying? In other words, this I think is where the claim came out. In other words, he claims he has 300 ohm on a full wave dipole CCD antenna, about 300 ohm peak, whereas says you. I think instead of you use a full wave dipole, the resistance is so much higher, it's much more harder to match. That in that case, you do better with a half wave dipole at 70 ohms, which is easier to match 70 ohms, something to that effect. So, in other words, he's claiming that because you have a match 300 ohms on full wave DCD antenna as compared to a full wave dipole, that the resistance is going to be tremendously higher, take over.
Yeah, there's a degree of correctness and incorrectness in that one, Bill. If I built an antenna at 70 ohms and I use conventional technique, I come up with a particular bandwidth, I'm going to use that as a standard. If I then built a 300 ohm antenna and I use some popular techniques to convert my 50 ohm transmission line up to 300 ohms, in general, I'm going to end up with a more narrow band antenna. But that isn't because the antenna is more narrow band. It's because my impedance matching technique is more narrow band. If I'm smart enough, I can build an impedance matching technique that matches between 50 ohms and 300 ohms, which is multiply octave wide. I can do it with ferrite. I'll admit that the ferrite starts running out of steam when you get to 1,000 megacycles. But if I'm at 30 megacycles and I build an impedance matching transformer, if I'm smart enough, I can make a 6-to-1 impedance matching transformer that covers 1.8 to 30 megacycles inclusive. And the impedance matching transformer would have no worse than a 1.5 standing wave ratio if I'm smart enough. So the fact that the antenna is 300 ohms doesn't make the antenna more narrowband. It may, in the ideal case, make it a little bit more broadband. I've done some experimenting along those lines, by the way. So, is a 300 ohm antenna more narrowband? I don't think so. Only the techniques you conventionally use to get there. And there are better techniques. K2KUI, KQRIW.
That is K2KUI, yeah. I can say there's so many different ideas out there. Whether or not this DCD antenna is worth purchasing or go through the amount of trouble to build this thing or buy it, I don't know. I tell you the truth, I don't think it's going to be that spectacular better than your regular dipole. I really am very, and that's my opinion, but I doubt it's going to be something to do. Oh boy, compared to my, pull down my dipole, put up another one, spend this kind of money and everything, and or go through the pains of making all this, I don't think you're going to see that spectacular difference in this dipole, the dipole or regular dipole. Again, that's my opinion, but I could be wrong. I'm sure somebody on 75 feet is going to tell me, you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, this is commonplace. Everything, I'm so careful on 75 feet. What I say is who I answer, whatever they come up with, because it starts a riot on that band. They really go at you. They come at you like you're in a bull ring there, a matador, and you're facing the bull. The
that this is the way I envision it. So I stay out of the ring there most of the time.
All right, so we'll let that go. All right, how do you feel, Dick? Are you up to any more of this?
I still want to roll. It's your choice, Bill.
Okay, look. Let's see, what do we do? We've got this CCP, none of this. Let me see if I can find something we can do something here. Oh, for God's sake, another antenna question. I'm telling you, what are we, strictly antenna? We don't bother that much. Oh, boy, what is this now? Let me think, what's happening? Oh, my God. I have a feeling these are questions, fool questions, that people are fool studies. I don't know. I feel funny that maybe we're cutting into instruction school. It's a question about point current and things like that. Gets into the formulation of what's happening as far as RF current that appears along a antenna. I don't know. Should we get into this thing, over?
I think we should, Bill. Of all the things we amateurs experiment with, in the case of 80 to 10 meters, for the most part, we don't build our transmitters anymore. We don't build our receivers anymore. Except for open wire line, we don't build our transmission lines anymore. The antenna support structure, the radio tower, we don't build the tower anymore. We buy that. Southeast Asia and Tennessee builds us our radios. The antennas are the last thing left that we fiddle with. And a gold-plated transmitter and receiver is useless without a good antenna with a good location for the antenna, properly fed. So antenna questions, I think, are almost the most valid for a TechNet mel. I mean, what can a TechNet discuss other than propagation techniques, modulation and demodulation techniques, and antennas? That's what RF is. And how you couple it to your computer, and how you get rid of the computer interference that's created. So antennas are probably our number one subject now, and how the current flows in the antenna, how the antenna really radiates, what does resonance mean, what does impedance mean, why does impedance go bad, and when the impedance is bad, why does it create a standing wave ratio, why do transmission lines behave like that? These are all very valid questions that many of the books do not cover well in a way that the guy could go out whistling that tune, so to speak. Just the basic resonance phenomenon of how an antenna radiates. The fact that I say the signal bounces back and forth on the antenna roughly 30 times before it gets radiated into space. That's what radiation really is. And what we call resonance is to make sure that those 30 bounces all stay in step with each other. If the antenna is a little bit too short, they go out of step and get leading in phase. If the antenna is a little bit too long, they get out of step, lagging in phase. In the first case, we call it capacitive, and in the second case, we call it inductive. So the main thing is the signal doesn't just flow down the wire once and jump into space. The signal has to bounce back and forth on that wire of your dipole 30 times before it finally leaves and goes into space. A little bit leaves on each bounce. I am positive, I give it 98% assurance that that is what is happening. That is real. I can't find any book that says those words. As such, the whole phenomena of antenna performance and radiation is a big black mystery to the average guy. For the first 20 years of my ham radio experience, the antenna was a big black mystery. I didn't know what in the world was going on in there. The best I could do is copy somebody else's design and pray that my variation of my particular materials that I use would give me the same performance as the guy who wrote the original article, and hope the original article was accurate and properly displayed in the magazine without errors. There's a lot of things to pray for in there. So I suspect antenna questions and the Smith chart and transmission lines and radiation characteristics and gain and VISWAR and beam width and Saturn. That's where half of the ham radio questions lie. other than computer interfacing and electromagnetic compatibility problems. That's what I think, Mel. So, you and I are in the antenna business, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, this is KY. This is a funny one. I'm just reading it because it says, Mel, you were famous with us for coming up with those nice, simple, straightforward formulas. Each one of them, you give a simple answer, and we just use the formulas, and boy, it really works. So here you go again. Oh, here, please go again with this one. For instance, I understand, okay, that with a center-fed dipole as a resonance, right, the RF current is maximum at the point in the voltage, okay? Now, as you go towards the end of the dipole, the current declines and the voltage. Okay. So now, is there a formula that will give the percentage of RF current that appears at various points along the side of an antenna? For instance, if 1 ampere is at the mean point, will be a quarter of the way to the end of the, or half the way towards the end of the dipole. Is there a formula? Yes, there is. I know the way. I know the simple way you can do this, but I'm going to turn it over to our resident Nathan, as they say. This you take it, and I'll get my so-called little simple formulation over.
Okay, because the antenna is a standing wave structure, because we know the current is maximum in the middle and nearly zero at the end, almost exactly zero at the end, the curve in between follows the cosine theta formula, the trigonometric cosine. We know the antenna, each half of the antenna, center out to one side, is a quarter wavelength long. Since the full wavelength is 360 degrees, we know that a quarter wavelength is 90 degrees. So, if I start at the center of the antenna, how much length have I walked down the antenna? Zero. 0 degrees. I take the cosine of 0 degrees, I get unity, 1.0. I walk halfway down the right-hand side of the dipole. The whole right-hand side of the dipole is 90 degrees long, quarter wavelength long, electronically. I walk halfway down it, I've walked 45 degrees. Cosine of 45 degrees is 0.707. Halfway down the right-hand side of that dipole, 70.70% of the current is flowing. If I go three-quarters of the way down the dipole, 0.75 times 90, that's three-quarters of the way, at 67.5 degrees, cosine of that is, do that again, press the wrong key, 0.75 times 90 is 67.5. The cosine of 67.5 is... My machine's giving me crazy answers here, old, but...
0.92 I have.
Cosine of 0 is 1. Cosine of 67.5. It's got to be a lot lower than 1.
9.2, I guess.
Yeah, I hear you. And I don't believe it. Cosine of 90 degrees has to be 0. It is. Cosine of 67 degrees, it's got to be something closer to 0. There's an error in my machine, or I'm not using it correctly. Maybe I don't have it in a degree mode.
Okay, let's see. Halfway, let's see, it's 45 degrees. The cosine would be 707. You have that?
Sure do.
Okay, quarter wave would be, it comes out 22.5 degrees. Then.
Wait a minute now. Quarter wave is 90 degrees.
Quarter of the way from the center. I said it backwards, of course. That's pretty good for me. A quarter of the way from the center is 22.5 degrees. You get that?
Sure do. AC2KSH with a question. My machine has got a failure of some kind. I just don't believe it. Person with a question, go right ahead.
Hey, good evening, Dick. I don't know, you may or may not remember me. I met you at the amateur radio at the field day. Remember you had that little green light or something you were showing to us?
I've shown that a lot of people, but go ahead with your question.
All right, first of all, I just want to say it was a pleasure meeting you that night anyway. I'm just curious, where did you get that laser light from again? I know, that's not exactly the subject you guys were talking about, but I was curious to get one of those lights, those laser pointers.
Yep. I bought it at the Astronomy Forum at Rockland Community College. The Rockland Astronomical Association, I think it is, for the last 10 or 15 years in a row, roughly in April or May, holds a astronomy forum at Rockland Community College, and there were something like 80 vendors there on Saturday and Sunday in a week in May. Read the appropriate issue of Sky and Telescope magazine or Astronomy magazine, and so a vendor there. You're about to ask me the vendor's name. If I search real hard, I may be able to find the receipt I got from him. However, there's a problem, and that is the laser you saw that I presented at the Limon Field Day site is not legal. That's why I think the guy gave me a receipt which proved that I had paid for it and allowed me to get out the door of the Astronomy Forum, but I think his name wasn't on it. You're not allowed to sell a laser above 5 milliwatts, which is considered eye safe. Above 5 milliwatts is not eye safe. That laser of mine is 30 milliwatts. And as such, if you highly misuse it, there's a slim chance you could do some damage to a guy's retina with it. So I think the vendor was Mr. X, if you know what I mean. Back to you, sir.
Oh, all right, I got you. All right, well, I don't want to cause any problems or anything. If they're not legal, I thought they were legal to have, but I have a laser pointer myself, but like you said, it's probably 5 milliwatts. It's not 30. The one you had was very impressive. I like that one. And I wasn't sure if you were able to buy them, legally or anything like that. I know they outlawed them in certain areas, and I wasn't sure if that was the case. All right, not a problem. And, listen, you guys have a great night, and, keep up the great work. You do a great job on the TechNet. I listen in every once in a while, so keep up the good work.
Hey, Mel, I just found out what's going on. The cosine key on my calculator has got a double bounce problem to it. So, therefore, I was putting in 67.5 degrees. It was giving me 0.38, which is the right number, and then the second bounce, it was taking the cosine of 0.38 degrees and coming out with 0.99. So the answer is 38%. So when you walk three-quarters of the way down the dipole, 38% of the current is left. So the current down the each half of the dipole follows trigonometric cosine. And just know that center is 0 degrees and the tip is 90 degrees and everything in between is a direct proportion. Take that number of degrees of cosine on your trig table of your calculator, and you know the exact current that flows in that area. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Hey, very good. This is K2KEY, okay? I'll make it simple. Whoever's listening, the current actually follows a sine curve. 0 at the end, 0 degrees, and 180 degrees. And maximum at the center, 90 degrees. So it's easy to consider the center at 0 degrees and the end at 90 degrees. So what you do, I think, just said, the cosine table. But to get cosine, basically, you look up the cosine of 0 degrees, it's 1. And showing the maximum current at the center. So again, the cosine of 0 degrees, look it up, it's 1. Showing the maximum current at the center. And think we just said the cosine of 90 degrees is 0. So that would show no current at the end. So we go halfway between that, we're at 45 degrees, that would be 0.707, and so on and so forth. So basically breaking it down, if you use the cosine table, you can find the current at any point along it. Correct, Dick? The cosine table, and you'll find the current at any other point. Simple enough to say it that way, over.
100% right, if and only if the dipole is uniform in diameter. It's a case now where you and I might make a 40-meter dipole out of pieces of tubing that are telescoped and is therefore tapered in diameter. It gets disturbed a little bit from that. Not a great deal. Now, we can therefore calculate the current on every long uniform dipole, along every length, every position, along a uniform diameter dipole. And if the dipole tapers, it gets more skinny near the end, the voltage on the current on the end decreases a little bit more rapidly. You'd also like to use a similar formula for figuring out what is the voltage at each place along the dipole. There, life gets a little bit more complicated because depending on whether you use fat materials or skinny materials, the curves that are in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, every edition except the first edition. The first edition is in Chapter 3, and the next three editions is in Chapter 4. There's a beautiful set of curves for the resistive impedance and the reactive impedance of every reasonable monopole. Now remember, a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. Now those curves will show you the resistive component and the reactive component. And so for every reasonable diameter, in other words, it's all done as a ratio of what's the ratio of the diameter to the length. And once you decide what is the diameter to length ratio of your particular dipole, you go to the appropriate curve in Chapter 4. It'll tell you exactly what you're going to get. And if you don't have access to that book, Antenna Engineering Handbook, you have access to those curves by going to the website of Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha .com, or is it .org, I keep forgetting, the WA1MBA website. At the bottom of that website are those curves, published by me, you could say. So that's to say, I gave those curves to Tom and he put them on his website. And it allows you to impedance match any dipole. To figure out what is the voltage at the end is a little bit more complicated because you get fringing effects. It's easier to measure the current. There's various techniques by which you can build a probe that you can put at various places on the dipole that tells you the current that's flowing in that area. There's various ways you can do that. To do the equivalent with voltage is a lot more difficult, and I don't recommend it. So let's hope that the person wasn't asking that question. Notice the voltage at the end is going to be a hell of a lot higher. Since the average dipole has a loaded Q of around 30, a dipole in free space, the voltage at the tip is roughly going to be 30 times higher than the voltages at the center. Very rough rule of thumb, but close enough for engineering practices. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks. This is K2KEY.
Great.
Very good. I'm just reading some of my blog. Some of them, I should say, I won't say anything to you on air, but someday if we have an eyeball, hopefully somebody thinks they're really going to really get, as they say, a charge out of it. I can't read that for sure. I'm just looking through if there's anything else here. I don't know. Continue here at 11:30. Do you want to try any more? Should I continue reading over?
Question about the cosine, WS2N.
I'll be with you in a minute, Paul. First, a quick question to you, Mel. When you said you can't read, is that because somebody was flaming us? You strongly disagree with something we said?
Helpful language.
Okay, yeah. There are people out there who hear you and I and this group that comes together expressing lots of opinions, and some of those opinions are very different than what they've been hearing on 20 meters and 80 meters for lots of years, and they think we're creating a hoax. All right. They're entitled to their opinion. Paul, go right ahead with the cosine.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing wrong. I put in 0, and I hit the cosine button, and I get 1. Then when I put in 45, and then I hit the cosine, I don't get 0.707. I get some other ridiculous number, whatever it is. But, are you doing something with the 45 before you hit the cosine?
You gotta be careful now. Many calculators have two different ways that they do trig functions, either in degrees or in radians. The majority of the inexpensive calculators take radians, not degrees. And you're about to ask, how do I convert from one to the other? Know that 180 degrees equals 1 pi radian. So the conversion factor is 180 over pi. So if I take 180 over pi as a constant and divide it by the number of degrees I'm interested in, I've got that backwards. I may have it backwards. You have to convert to radians. In fact, your machine may have a key that converts degrees to radians. But many of the machines only calculate the trig function in radian measure. 2 pi radian, 6.23 is really 360 degrees, if you know what I mean. 6.24, what is it now? 3.14, 6.28 is really 360 degrees. 360 degrees equals 6.28 radians. Crazy. Why do they do it that way when most of us think in degrees? Well, my particular calculator, I can tell it by going to the right screen. I live in the degree world, not the radian world, so do all my trig functions in degrees. Calculators that don't have that also have somewhere in there degrees to radian conversion. So if you want to make a measurement in degrees, you have to first convert it to radians before you take the cosine. And I can tell you what the answer was going to be. In fact, I'm going to put my machine right now into the radian mode. I just did it. And now I'm going to go back to the trig function. I'm going to put in 45 degrees. And I'm going to calculate the cosine. And I got 5.525. Is that what you got? Go ahead.
I got 0.525 and a bunch of numbers after that. Got it.
Your machine is calculating radians. So you've got to find the right key in there that converts degrees to radians before you do the cosine function, or you've got to find the right screen where it allows you to convert all the, where it allows you to enter all of your trig functions in degrees. My machine, I can convert it from degrees to radians in the way I enter the information into the trig function. So I think we figured that one out. Back to you, Paul.
See, now that's terrible. Yeah. This guy's going to have... You know, that wrote the email, and we'll be, you know, if he's got the wrong calculator, he'll be better off doing it, you know, the old-fashioned way on paper and pen, with paper and pen. I mean, that's not good. Yeah, I see the word, they got RAD written above this whole thing for an answer.
That explains it. Now, either you find out how to mathematically convert degrees to radians before you go and ask your machine for the cosine function, or many, many old-fashioned math books will tell you what the sines and cosines and tangents are. The trig table in any good math book. The chemical rubber table, mathematical table book, for instance, the very popular one, used for years and years. So, and I'm sure there are websites that'll tell you what is the cosine of 45 degrees. So there's lots of ways a guy can get it, but yes, he has to know that most of the inexpensive calculators live in the radian world. The reason they do that is that it's a little bit cheaper to do the burning of the problem that way. And so therefore they did it that way, and they said, we're going to throw the problem in your lap. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that's a good Radio Shack calculator. That's the scientific programmable calculator. So I thought it should be able to do that. Maybe it, I guess I'll get the book out and try to figure out how to go about doing that. But, you know, I've got everything from log functions to hyperbole, you know. I was thinking maybe the cosine, you know, minus one factor. I tried that, but that didn't work. My second function would be. But, okay, very good, Dick. I was wondering, you know, I'm going along, I'm getting these different numbers than you and Mel. At first I thought I was on track, but your numbers were completely different with your double punching on the keys there. But very good. Another problem solved. Back to you.
Yeah, when you read your manual from Radio Shack, there's a chance that it's got a screen you can go to where you tell the machine, I live in the degree world, not the radian world. And 98% of the engineers live with degrees. Very few of us. Only the pure mathematicians love radian measure. When you're taking differential calculus, differential integration, there it has to be done in radians for a bunch of crazy reasons. But that's not the world you and I live in when we want to know what angle has a cosine of 0.707. You and I call that 45 degrees. K2KDY. Your choice if you go any further. K2LAW.
Okay, very good. K2KDY. I advise that, use the cosine table in the book. I always say that because, Dick, I guess that's where I grew up with. Table. That's it. And have all these buttons and things to push. I don't know. Just get into many problems with it. I just don't think with viral, so that's pretty good. All right. So, here we are. Let me read on. Oh my God. This is two pages of massive science that if I would critique this piece. Oh my Lord. Got a bunch of calculations, differentials.
Wow.
Bunch of stuff. Two pages. I can't sit down and do this all this math checking for a meeting. Holy God. Ham? Oh, he writes here because I'm a fellow ham radio operator. Can I be his Elmer and do his math piece? It's very important that I have this somebody else check my accuracy. Can you imagine this dick over?
Here we are, Dick. Wow. That's what I said when you first read that mail. Wow. A rich recognizer. I'll get to you in a second. Considering the fact that the guy wants his PC vetted, as they say, in other words, he wants somebody to review it to find any possible errors, in a way, I don't blame him for asking. He does have a desire. However, it is beyond the scope of what you and I volunteer as absolutely free service to these people. It's above and beyond the call of duty. So, in that respect, it is not reasonable. No. It's too far afield from the ham radio we're trying to teach each other, the antenna theory, and transmission line theory, and transmitters and receivers, and demodulation and modulation. We're trying to teach people wireless radio frequency techniques. And the deep math of a math thesis is pretty far left of center. So I think we can't volunteer for that one. Rich, go right ahead. You want to ask us a deep physics question, Rich? Go right ahead.
I wanted to see the ball to make that conversion from radian to degrees. One radian is 57.3 degrees. Can't he just multiply?
You said multiply and you mean divide, yes. He can take however number of degrees he's interested in. Divided by 57.3. In fact, I'm going to do it right now. It is 180 divided by pi. And I take the numeric equivalent of that, 57.29577. Call it 57.3, yes. However many degrees you're interested in, divide 57.3 into it. Now you've got radian, and you can go into the, what's the word for it? Go into the trig table of your particular calculator. And that's a good enough approximation. If you want to be exact, it's 180 divided by pi. Back to you, Rich. Do you want to make any further comments on that?
Okay, yeah, I meant divide into it. Yeah, that might help Paul in doing that conversion from radians to degrees, because I remembered one radian to 57.3 degrees. You guys continue.
You got it, Rich. I mean, Mel.
Okay, just want to make sure that I'm not the guy that they come after when they said I can't do all the pieces. You know, that a little bit, that's a little too much, even though it's a fellow, supposedly a fellow man. All right, and yes, as far, yeah, I think we did a toolage on the radius and all the vector of the United States. A couple of problems with that. I believe I did that. One of our controls, I don't remember which one. Let's see. Anything else here? The 75 meters, I did say 75 meters. Oh my God, that was
comes up on 75 is these questions and all. This is filtering out 75 questions. You got to be careful to make sure I can put this out on here. It's all about data. Want to hang on a second?
Well, I'll stand by, sir.
Okay, so I boiled it down because there's a whole thing here. I want, basically, my signal, if I raise my antenna up 20 feet higher, on 75 meters, one guy says to me, because you're raising it up, the extra loss in the cable, see, here we go, the extra loss in the cable would simply negate any advantage to greater height that I would give. Now, I don't know how high his antenna is on 75 to begin with. Okay. So, now, you think that they will hear the difference if I raise the antenna? Well, I guess if your antenna is 100 feet, 120 feet up, just going up 20 more would be something. But if your 75 meters antenna is about, I don't know, low 35, 25, 35, 40 feet above ground, I guess maybe if you go up 24 feet, you're going to say, could it do something, but I doubt it. I guess, again, it has to be where it is right now, but no, I will say that you're not going to have any the cable, extra cable, not going to negate the advantage of going up 20 feet. Stuff like that. This, how do you like this one, take over?
K6TPZ with a comment.
Comment?
And lots of people, lots of comments on this particular one. And that's an old wives' tale, that the extra length is going to be the extra loss. Any reasonable transmission line on 80 meters, 20 feet of it, has a loss that's so low that it's hard to measure. On top of that, 20 feet on 80 meters is 0.076 wavelength. 7.6% of a wavelength. That's not very much. Not a great deal is going to happen unless you're starting off with the antenna that's 15 feet off the ground. For every propagated path you care about on 80 meters, depending on the state of the atmosphere, how far away that guy is, and what time of day it is, in theory there is an ideal altitude. On 80 meters, the highest possible altitude is better more times, but it's not always the best. If the guy you want to talk to on 80 meters is very close, you want to need this antenna, near, vertical, incident, skyway, antenna. You want the antenna fairly close to the ground. You want to bounce the signal straight up to the ionosphere and back down into Pennsylvania, so to speak. So, to talk to somebody that's really close by, like Pennsylvania, you might intentionally want the dipole a little bit high, a little bit low. Whereas if you mount the dipole on 80 meters real high, there is a slim possibility you create a null on the position in Pennsylvania where that guy is. Every horizontally polarized dipole above Mother Earth has a real dipole above the Earth and a mirror image of the dipole below it. That ground looks like dirt and grass to your eye and asphalt. But to a radio wave, it's almost a perfect meter on a perfect mirror on 80 meters. As such, the real antenna above, the mirror image below, which is always 180 degrees out of phase, gives you this vertical pattern that you go through any of the good antenna books, it'll tell you exactly what your antenna vertical pattern is going to look like versus number of wavelengths that your antenna is above the ground. So that's a given. So he's going to get a substantial change if the antenna is 15 feet off the ground, he's going to move it 20. If the antenna is 80 feet off the ground, he's going to move it to 100. It's going to be very difficult for him to see any difference. Moving 7.5% of a wavelength. I keep you better to see what the hell you have to say.
Yeah, hi, Dick and group. I was just listening. A 3.7 megacycle is a loss characteristic so minute it won't even enter into the equation.
Yeah, 100% right. Any reasonable coax cable on 80 meters or any reasonable open wire line, we're talking about a couple of tenths of a dB per 100 feet of the transmission line. 20 feet is nothing. So whoever told him this extra law, maybe the person is talking about some variation in ground reflection loss
or maybe he's talking about some change in loss of getting above or below the local trees, water tower, building, or whatever. But, all right, there was another person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that?
WX2N.
Paul, and I think it was the third person. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, we'll go on too quick. I'm still back with the cosine. Thank you, Rich, for the information on the 7.3. Clicking around on the button stick, I found something that says DGR that I really never used, and D for degrees, R for radians, G for grad. I'm not sure what that does, but that gives you a completely different number as well. But I do come up with the degrees and then the correct answer for instance, like with the 45 in. Hit cosine, and I get my 0.707. Dick, back to you.
Hey, you got it made. Degrees, 0 to 360 is a full circle. In radians, 0 to 6.28 radians is a full circle. In grads, 0 to 400 degrees, 400 grads is a full circle. I think, what do they call it now? Surveying people, I think, use grads. Almost nobody else. Grads are pretty rare. Radians, except for the mathematicians that are doing integration and differentiation, radians are a little bit rare. The majority of we go out to a convenience store and we buy this thing called a compass, which is measured in 0 to 180 degrees. And how many times have you seen one of those plastic things that's calibrated in radians? Very, very rare. So, thank goodness your machine's got the conversion. Mel, back to you.
Would anybody else like to make comments? Or somebody else? All right, Dick. So, the machine here in short order. Just look. And I have to look at some others yet. So I guess we just let it go over to midnight because I can say so. We get the discussion. What does this guy do? Warren. God. That's what I remember about Warren. I don't remember so much about him. Like this. The question about Caitlin Warren. this is something. There's a whole thing about it. I think we'll just pass on it right now. I think we ought to just let it go for tonight because it is getting kind of late. K2RIW, the tech message is K2RIW.
I think you're right, Mel. I think we've gone far enough. I own a whole book on Loran's C navigation system. A very, very well-designed system in its day. The predecessor to global positioning satellites. If we didn't have global position satellites and you want to do nautical navigation, Loran's C was the right way. And it made multiple attempts to abandon the system because GPS is supposed to take over. Well, there are a lot of boats that still are well-equipped with Loran, not well-equipped with GPS, and GPS has its problems. So the ideal system, if you can afford it, is to have both and play them against each other. As good as GPS is, there are cases where if you're inside of a metal building, if you're in a forest, depending on the brand name you're using, you may not get a fix. It may not tell you where the heck you are. Whereas Loran, over water, gives some beautiful answers. Over land, the answers are not quite as good, but if you're smart enough, you can use some correction factors. A Loran signal at 100 kc propagates, or is it 1.8 meg? That's the old system. Anyhow, I think it's 100 kc. It propagates slightly differently over land as opposed to over water. So it gives you a slightly different position. But, it would still allow somebody to find you, I think. What you guys have just heard is TechNet number... Where did I write down the number here? There it is. 1,147 of the TechNets that began way back in September of 1982. What is that now? This coming September will be our 25th year of the TechNet, essentially every Sunday. So that means, about 49 of them or so per year for 25 years. Where various people think we're crazy to do this. It's a labor of love. And I get some exposure. And we get challenged. some of the emails that Mel gets, you can tell, are very challenging. 73-year-old, we'll be back next week. Keep those cards and letters coming. To Mel, I don't volunteer. And go easy with this, fellas. We're attempting to do good, even though we may be stepping on some people's toes and giving opinions that are drastically different than the traditional opinion. Mel and I think out of the box a little bit. So go easy with the poor guys. Bye-bye. K2KEY for any other comments. K2RIW.
Hey, very good. Reputation now as a simple formula guy. All right. Well, I always, as Nick said, you know, we back in the dark ages did things with tables, you know, math tables that were in almost every book you got, geometry, algebra, you know, always had the tables in there. So if you still have one of those books around, I would think that you can download them. Maybe sometimes it's really easy to use them. In the meantime, the emails coming in, as Nick says, remember, even within the realm of amateur radio as much as possible. And yes, I will never comment much. I know a couple that they keep coming up with names of different products, which product do you prefer over the other. I will not answer that. It's one man's opinion, and I think it would be wrong for me to make a comment, because unless I have really experienced all the products of that line, you know, and even then I would be subjective to what I interpret. So try to keep it within the realm of amateur radio, you know, general questions, and we'll be more than glad to help you. Everybody have a great week. Thank you for joining us. This is K2KEY and K2RIW with Jack Neff, saying 73 to all.